Hi, I'm Marcus Edwards, and I'm interested in talking to people who are interested in talking to people who are interested in having a conversation about their future. Does that make any sense? I don't know. Anyway, welcome to Recruiting Trailblazers. So I'm very excited to welcome my guest today to Recruiting Trailblazers. Kate Brogdon has over a decade of search experience and founded her company, Evolve Partners, in 2012. It's a boutique national executive search and recruiting firm. Evolve focuses on filling key roles across accounting and finance, technology, marketing, and growth disciplines. Previously, Kate was a CPA at PricewaterhouseCoopers, where she developed the passion to improve the recruiting and executive search industry. So welcome to the podcast, Kate Brogdon.
Thank you, Marcus. Happy to be here.
Great. I'm glad we can make this happen on a Friday. It's good to see you. And we're going to have a great chat. I love talking to agency founders about their recruiting mindset and really figuring out, you know, what makes a company tick and some of the secrets to your success. So that's what we're going to do in this conversation today. So, Kate, going back a few years to 2012, when you started Evolve, you were at PwC as a CPA. What was the catalyst to your entrepreneurial journey?
Great question. You know, the same as probably everyone else as I fell into it, but I'll back that up to how I ended up figuring out recruiting was right for me coming out of PwC. So there were a few points in time that, you know, growing up, I wanted to be a teacher, then I wanted to be a lawyer, then I wanted to go into business. And when I was at PwC, I wasn't finding my space. And so I sat back and looked at all those interests together and actually had a PwC partner of mine suggest recruiting and said, you know, you love advising people, you're a people person, you know, accounting and finance, you know, and you want something that's tied, you know, you want compensation tied to your success. You should go into recruiting. I had never thought about recruiting. So really just fell into it when I left PwC and I started at a small search firm for a year. And then in 2012 decided, you know, I can do this better and wanted to start a company of my own.
So you had a year's experience working for a company. Did you begin to see opportunities during that year where you thought you could do it better? Bring better processes and better ideas to the table?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's what drove it is what, you know, I saw a lot of things that I disagreed with and that I wanted to do better. So absolutely. I mean, probably 6-9 months in was when I started realizing, you know, I need to do this on my own. There's a lot of different ways to do it. I think when you sit back as an employee and you're advising owners on, you know, maybe we should be doing it that way or this way. That was really when it clicked was, you know, why am I telling others how to do this when I don't agree with how they do? And that's what really started it.
Yeah. In that year of learning after you left PwC, do you remember what the sort of the biggest area of opportunity was where you thought, I can definitely do this better, that bit's broken, or, you know, there's a challenge that I would really like to conquer?
Absolutely. I think it was around innovation. And that's where the name Evolve came from, was I felt recruiting was stuck in the past. There's still a lot of areas that are stuck in the past and done how they were many, many years ago.
Yes.
And that was it. There was a lack of innovation and just a do how you've always been told. A phrase that I really don't like is, you know, this is how it's always done, so do it. You know, I don't believe in that. So to give you an example, you know, I was held to, like many people, cold calling metrics. You know, I had to make 300 calls every single week, no matter what. Mm-hmm. I was not a cold caller. I wasn't getting value. I was jumping into LinkedIn. LinkedIn was, you know, relatively new. No one was really using it in that agency. And I said, that's where I'm getting the value. Let my metrics be tied to that, or let me reevaluate the metrics. And it was just a hard no, make your calls. So I'd sit after hours and just dial and sit on the phone just to get the number there for no reason.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of call metrics these days. I think that's a bit of an outdated approach. But I mean, activity metrics are good when they're used to help specifically like junior or younger recruiters in their career just understand the type and the level of activity that needs to be committed to on a daily basis. So they're good for that reason. But
yeah,
and we'll probably touch on metrics a little bit later in this conversation. I don't believe in using metrics to threaten people. I believe in using metrics to educate people and help people, you know, fly the plane straight and level to understand what they need to be doing on a daily, weekly basis to probably drive the most optimal result. And
exactly.
So I think an understanding of metrics can really help. But I think a lot of the bigger firms tend to use them in more of a threatening fashion. And really, you are the sum of your metrics every single week. So that forces, I think, some bad behavior across the industry.
Exactly. And everybody's different.
Yeah.
Certain metrics work for certain people. So I think that needs to be evaluated based on who your team member is.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, your background as a CPA is obviously invaluable to you in the recruitment marketplace, because you can really, you know, just not only talk the talk, but you can walk the walk. You've got credibility and you can genuinely understand, you know, the career challenges that people in those accounting and finance markets face. But when you started your role as a recruiter and then very quickly as an entrepreneur and a leader, what didn't PwC prepare you for? What was the biggest challenge that you faced as you moved into this new role as a recruiter and a leader?
That's a good question. I truly think PwC laid an excellent foundation in many areas. I still recommend going that route as a foundation to your career, even if you're not sure what you want to do. So I did feel very prepared. I think the one thing I wasn't ready for, which every recruiter listening would appreciate, is the roller coaster and the ups and downs. You're selling people on every side of the fence, and you know, you just get hit hard over and over, and you just have to learn from it, almost numb it out and keep going and know that it works out in the end. So I think that was the most difficult transition for me.
That's a great answer. And I think it's the right answer as well, because the one thing that nobody's really prepared for when they first start in this business is the amount of rejection and disappointment that you have to face. And making that a part of your day and a part of your week and a part of your whole sort of being, there's no way you can dodge the raindrops in this business. And, you know, every time you are rejected or you do face a big disappointment, you're probably closer to your next deal. And I think it's the hardest part of becoming a recruiter, developing that resilience and that resistance to, you know, all of those feelings of disappointment and rejection. And I actually think that, you know, the best people in this business are the people who can brush it off the quickest.
Yeah, definitely.
What about the sales side of the business when you first came in? Because you probably weren't doing a lot of selling at PwC, or were you?
No selling at PwC. That was definitely a weakness and something I had to learn over the years. And it all came down to relationships, and it still does. You know, I would reach out to prior clients, prior colleagues. People would come to me. I was very, you know, prevalent, not as much these days, but on LinkedIn and trying to be out there and social so people knew me and knew what I was doing. So I would say it's been a very organic relationship driven, but BD, I think, is something that every recruiter struggles with and is extremely difficult without those relationships.
Yeah. Yeah. So Kate, after a year of working at this recruitment company, you left PwC, you worked for a year as a recruiter, and then you started your own firm, which is astonishing to think that just with 1 year of experience, you had the confidence and the ability to go ahead and build your own search firm. What would you do differently now going back? Do you remember, I mean, were there moments of complete panic, or was there a minute where you thought this isn't going to work out, or did you just hit it out the park?
I don't know that there's anything I'd do differently. I've learned a lot through it all, and you can't know all that without going through it. Regardless of the amount of books you read or coaches you talk to. So honestly, maybe I'm a little bit crazy and I just don't have regret. And I think everything happens for a reason, and I don't let myself fail. So I never had that inclination of this might fail. This won't work.
Right. Yeah.
You just make it work and you work harder. You do more. You talk to more people. You get advice. So, no, it was great. And I was passionate about it. To this day, I'm passionate about changing and improving the recruiting process, both for candidates and clients. I think there needs to be a ton of improvement. And starting that first day in 2012, I wanted to build that culture, and I'm still building it. So it was a passion.
That's fantastic. Let's talk about some of the cornerstones that you've built Evolve around that help you stand out as a search firm. And the best place to start is probably with the people. So you're a small firm, but you know what it's like to hire the right people and to build a culture. What are the attributes that you're looking for when you interview and hire recruiters for your firm?
Absolutely. I think people, like you said, are the cornerstone of success. And so we are always looking for and hiring those who want to work in a collaborative environment, who want to learn about business and grow. So that's something that's different with us, is that we really put on this team environment. Yes, we're all in sales and we're all trying to close deals, but none of that matters if it's damaging the brand and the growth of Evolve as a company itself. So that is something we screen for immediately, is someone that's interested in business, interested in getting involved in the strategy, wants to work together as a team to provide the best possible service.
And sometimes that can be hard to build a collaborative environment, because there is an element of competition that happens within those walls as well of the company. And, you know, people make commission and people do deals and people help other people do deals. Do you ever struggle with that sort of dynamic, the competitive dynamic, as opposed to the collaborative one?
To be honest, we have not. It's pretty shocking when I look back over the past 12 years, you know. We have never had an employee leave or lost someone due to culture and how we operate. So not sure what the secret sauce is. I think I've lucked out with some really great hires, you know, at the leadership level that really believe in this. And, you know, we show it from the top down. I share in a lot of wins. I will pass candidates. You know, I take ownership of losses. So luckily, we really have not had a problem.
That's great. And you compensate your team. It's not a commission-driven environment, is it? You pay base salaries.
It's base salary with commission on top. So it's not the same amount as a commission if you were on a draw. But we wanted to incentivize that team environment and not have this, you know, gun to your head for you got to close a deal by the end of the month or you're going to be negative.
Yeah, that's great. Now, one of the hardest parts of running a boutique agency is performance management. How do you measure and manage, you know, the performance of your team, but whilst keeping everybody motivated?
Yes, we do start with, you know, some baseline numbers and metrics for new hires or those that don't have recruiting experience, because like you said in the beginning, it is helpful. You need to start somewhere. Activity is what produces results, but that will never be a reason for letting someone go or coming down on them. Rather, we look at ratios. So, you know, we are looking at submission to interview, interview to placement. We are then looking at tenure of placements, number of promotions and how quickly promotions happen of our placements. So we are really focused on quality metrics rather than just hard numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think those are interesting ratios. Submission to interview ratios, that really tells a story, doesn't it? That tells the story of how well you've understood the requirement, how good your matchmaking skills are, and maybe points a finger at urgency as well. If you've got a high ratio, if you're just not scoring the interviews, you know, maybe the client's not as serious as they said they were in the beginning and they're being too picky. But those ratios do tell a big story about what's happening on that particular role, don't they?
That's exactly right. It's great for training the candidate or the recruiter for performance. But to your point, it's great for assessing clients. So that's the beauty of agency and why I love agency recruiting, is you pick your clients and we can choose to work with who we truly believe in and we, you know, enjoy working with. So there have been many times that we've gone back and looked at results on a, you know, year over year basis. and seen a client that, you know, had 25 submissions and never ended up in a placement or ended up in one placement, that's still a terrible ratio that we say, maybe this client doesn't make sense for us, or we can advise them better on how to fix the process.
Yeah. And I think that often happens on the contingency side of the fence, where you've got organizations who are using agencies for the wrong reasons. They're using agencies not necessarily to fill the role, but to find the perfect candidate or see if the perfect candidate's actually out there, and not have that sort of that urgency to specifically fill that role, which is why I like the container model and retained searches as well, because then you've got a client that's betting on you to win as opposed to a client that's betting on you to lose. By the way, you do some contingency, but you do a lot of retained as well, yeah?
We do. We do a little bit of contingency. We do a lot of container, like contained searches, and also retained. So I can absolutely speak to, yeah, the value and the belief in each of those.
Why do you like the contained model?
So many reasons. But the contained model is great because we are able to bring retained search-like services to a much broader audience. So traditionally, when people think of retained search, they think executive only, C-suite, or the large national or global firms. You know, it's enormously expensive. We wanted to be able to bring that level of service to smaller, our client base, which is VC-backed, PE-backed companies, smaller companies that, you know, maybe their budget's not as large. And they need that education from below the C-suite. You know, there's value in understanding the market. So our container model, to step back, is a true exclusive partnership with a client. We sign on day one, and everyone has a different definition of container. We charge 10% of our placement fee every single month as a non-refundable service fee. And in that, you build a true partnership where we then have the time to go to market and provide this market research, market mapping, you know, data, just like a retained search firm would.
That's amazing because, I mean, when you've got skin in the game from the client, it becomes a true partnership. And I've argued about this on Recruiting Trailblazers before. I think the problem with contingency is that clients just don't have any skin in the game. And so they treat you the way they treat you. And it's very hard to sort of to set those meaningful expectations up front because they're not paying you yet. You know, it's no fill, no fee. And I think, you know, it does damage the industry and also damages the morale of recruiters who do a ton of work and then are told that, you know, they got an internal referral and none of the candidates that, you know, they submitted would be getting an interview.
Exactly. And another issue with contingency, I think there is a time and place for contingency, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, but I do too.
Yeah, one issue is that, which we've talked about before, is that it really incentivizes speed above all else. Even if you're an exclusive agency on a contingent search, you're going against the internal team, the internal recruiters. So the only way to protect yourself is to get that resume in there first. And in that case, you cannot sit back and focus on quality or collect resumes and present the top three. So it's great for speed, but it's terrible for quality.
I mean, I don't like when doing a container, I'm not a fan of competing with them, with my client. And so I'm usually going to ask questions like, you know, can I have control of the pipeline? If you want the best of the best, and if you want us to go out and headhunt for you and to use our long-standing relationships to really go deep and find you the very best candidate, it doesn't make sense for us to compete with you. If you've got candidates in your pipeline, let's see them through first and then we'll begin our search. I think there's a lot of ways to skin this one.
Yeah,
and that's interesting that you do 10% a month. I've only ever done sort of just a fixed fee up front.
Yeah,
and it doesn't need to be a big fee, actually, just to help them realize that they do have skin in the game. Even if it's $2,500 or $5,000 up front against the balance, you can be sure that once they've paid that, they're going to respond to your calls. They're going to give you immediate feedback on resumes and interviews. It's sort of the gift that keeps on giving. You just have to get them over that fence of paying a little bit up front, and then you've got a company that's betting on you to win, which I think is amazing.
I agree. And yeah, I've seen plenty of people do that as well, like the one-time upfront fixed fee. We like to do it on a monthly basis, so it's a continued partnership and continued data. One thing about the contained search that I don't know if many people are doing, but that we like to provide is that, you know, if you have your internal candidate or, you know, a company is considering promoting someone internally, but they want to go to market to see if that makes sense. Is that the best candidate? Does the comp make sense? Our container model will allow them to say, okay, here's 1 month of container. Can you provide us the data against our candidate? Tell us market insight, market comps, comparable candidates. And that's a win-win for everybody. You know, they've gotten the data they need to make their decisions internally. We got paid for the, you know, amount of work we did for those 4 weeks. And
that's interesting. That's so interesting because I haven't heard of that before. Mm-hmm. Is that something you've done multiple times?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That is interesting because then you're really acting as a research agency rather than a placement firm. But there's nothing wrong with getting paid to do the work. And if people want to pay you to do the work that you naturally do and are set up to do, then I think that's a win-win situation, as long as they're upfront about the fact that they're not serious about hiring anybody right now. They just want to know a bit more about that position in the marketplace.
Yep. And it can work either way. Sometimes they don't know if, you know, that relationship will continue. So, you know, if it continues, great. If we make a placement, great.
Yeah.
We get the full placement fee. If they walk away after a month, we're not upset. We got paid for the work that we did. So
good. Containers are good. Retainers are good. And as you said, that there is a place for contingency as well.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about your process. In the pre-call, we touched upon you have a very comprehensive intake process, don't you? Which I think is amazing. Can you sort of talk me through why that is and what that looks like?
Absolutely. We are obsessed with efficiency and trying to not make repeatable or duplicate work. And so that will come back all the way to our intake process and forward. So when we get a new client, we request a minimum of an hour time, if not multiple meetings, to learn everything about the business, their revenue models, you know, the challenges with the role in the past, where they want the role to go in the future, the team, you know, and we end up building, you know, anywhere between a call it 4 to 6, 4 to 7 page report on the company, the role, the growth story, you know, questions we should be asking our candidates, things we should be looking out for. And then we disseminate that across our team. We have a big kickoff call where we walk through the whole thing and have an open discussion. This typically lasts almost an hour. This is way more time than most people would ever do. You know, what I was used to in my old firm was, hey, here's a JD in a comp range. Go find some people. That takes 2 minutes.
Send some resumes.
Exactly. Yeah. So now we're a couple hours in when we kick off a search. But what's great about this is it gets the entire team educated and informed enough to sell just as good as you, the client owner. So now I'm not the only one doing the job, or if I want to take a vacation, the rest of my team can do just as well as I could.
And do you ever get pushback when you say, yeah, we're going to need an hour? I'm a huge fan of that because I think, again, that speaks to the seriousness of the search. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a very important part of the relationship development process with the client and a way to sort of flex your process in front of them to show them how in depth you're going to go on, you know, their organization, the functions of their business, the culture, the org chart, everything.
Yeah.
And then to be able to position yourself as a brand ambassador. And I think those are the right words to use. You know, we want to be your brand ambassador in the marketplace. Therefore, we need to know everything about you and this organization and the opportunity that this role represents.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, our clients are VC, PE-backed companies. Their names aren't out there. So that's what we're pitching is let us get your story out there. These folks are so amped up about what they're building, but the market doesn't know about it. So let us tell that story. So a lot of times they're excited to share their, you know, passion for it or growth story. You know, we have what's called an upfront contract, which I learned in one of my, you know, sales training, where we share with a client on the first call, in the first, you know, 15-minute intro call, these are the expectations. So it's not out of the blue we're asking for these things. Like we say up front, this is how our process works. And if you'd like to sign this engagement, like they're already aware it's coming.
Yeah. And look, if a client doesn't want to take the time to do that, maybe they're not the right client. You know, maybe they're just
not serious
enough to do it. And I think it's easy to push back. I say easy. It's never easy to push back on an opportunity because you don't want to lose it. But I think you have to put a stake in the ground and say, look, this is how we do this. And if you want the best result, we need to go through this comprehensive intake process.
Exactly. And it comes back to the go for the no. You know, we tell our team that all the time. I'd rather know up front if it's not a fit or not going to work than halfway through. So we've absolutely, it's not often, but we've turned clients away that will not give us the time of day to do a proper intake and kickoff. In the end, that's going to spin everybody's wheels. So I'd rather know that up front.
Do you then produce documentation? You say 6 to 7 pages. Do you then produce like a brochure on the role and the company?
We don't, but that is something that we're actually considering doing for more of our routine search roles. Yeah. But right now, we're not.
So you've got this comprehensive process and then you get into the sourcing side of the equation. What do you guys do that defines you as an outstanding search firm from a sourcing process point of view?
Yeah, I think it follows along, you know, with the amount of intake that we do. We actually then go through and do a market mapping and allocation for our team. And we'll even do this for contingent roles because it's not always about just because we can give that data to the client, but it's to make our team more efficient. So we'll actually build out a map, you know, call it a list of 10 areas that we're going to target for this candidate pool, and we'll allocate it across the team or let the team jump in and pick the areas that they want to focus on. And this is so there isn't duplicate efforts. In traditional contingency models, it's, again, here's the JD to the whole team. Everyone have at it. So this is a much more methodical, you know, let's not all step on each other's toes and search the same pipelines over and over again. You know, we all have our lanes. And then it's also a great marketing tool and a tool for our clients because we can say, we're confident we have covered the market for this. You know, maybe we're not getting what we need. We should expand to over here. So it also helps with clients quite a bit.
How transparent are you with your clients about how deep you've gone in terms of how many people you've reached out to, how many people you've spoken to? Do you freely share that information with your client, or does that really just begin at submission stage?
No, we absolutely share that for our select container clients and absolutely our retainer clients. We're sharing number of outreach, number of meetings, number of people that have come back and said no, that were a fit and why. So we're really able to dissect that data and we absolutely share it.
And clients like that kind of feedback. They like that consultative approach.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're willing to shift on must-haves and nice-to-haves with that feedback, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. It makes it a lot easier than just a subjective conversation. And one other thing we do with our sourcing process that I'm sure is very different than a lot of other agencies is we have shared pipelines and projects. So anyone that I hire that comes from another agency is shocked, but we keep everything public. So if anyone uses, you know, LinkedIn, RPS, there's pipelines to build out your candidate pools. And you can make them private to yourself. So if you have a search, build your pipeline of candidates you want to reach out to and so forth. We actually make those pipelines public across the firm and they're shared.
Right.
So that.
Right.
Again, nobody's duplicating, but what's really great is it's for future reference. When we get another search that is similar, we jump back to that pipeline. That's one great tool. The second is training new hires. So if someone new comes in, we can say, hey, go review. Here's the JD, the client overview, the market mapping, and here's the public pipeline that we did for that search. And it helps people get up to speed really quickly.
Yeah. And you transfer all that data into your ATS?
We do. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the other things that you mentioned in the pre-call was the importance of building a personal brand. I'm a big fan of this. I mean, that's one of the reasons I do the podcast. I talk a good game anyway. I think it's hard to build a personal brand. There's so many people out there who want to help us build personal brands. How are you going about it? And what kind of consequences are there to getting it right?
It's something that I'm very passionate about. I think everyone should have a personal brand, you know, wherever that may be. For us, it's of course LinkedIn. But I believe that's the future, not even the future. I think it's here now for recruiting, and not enough people are doing it. I'm actually shocked at how few people are doing it. But you've got to put your value out there. You know, there's so many recruiters. The job markets are diluted. The messaging is diluted. So you need to start creating content that puts value to your network out there. What I don't believe is, you know, just posting to post. You know, there's a balance that you make sure what you post actually adds value to your network. And it doesn't have to be 100,000 followers. You know, you could have, call it 5,000, but they're all in your network. And those are the people you want to be talking to. So I believe in keeping it focused as well. But I think a personal brand, you know, is so important.
Yeah, I think if you're just posting your job orders on your LinkedIn feed, then you're missing a trick. It's funny because people love connecting with people on LinkedIn. But then quite often they do nothing with that connection. And the best thing you can do with your connection is to keep in touch with them, you know, one to many, by posting on LinkedIn regularly on topic, you know, about what you do and how you do it and how you can differentiate yourself and the value that you can drive into the market. So when it does come time to take some of those relationships offline, maybe for the first time, it's a much easier process, isn't it? Because they're like, oh, Marcus, yeah, no, I see your podcast posts all the time and your posts about the recruiting process. Yeah, definitely open for a conversation. But if you've got 7,000 followers or connections on LinkedIn and you never post, then when you do start wanting to activate those connections, it's much, much harder.
Well, it's pointless. It's cold. I mean, there is no relationship. There is no visibility. You know, don't get me started on the LinkedIn algorithm. And if you post once, it's not rewarded. No one will see it. It won't be put out there. But also, you know, it's an example of you and I. I mean, our intake call, I feel like I've known you forever. And it was an easy conversation because I follow your content and I feel like I know you. And that's the same thing for us as recruiters on LinkedIn. You know, it's a much easier conversation. I had a great story where I was hiring a recruiter recently in a completely different market, different geography. And throughout the process, she was progressing to meet our VP, Megan. And when she heard me say that, she laughed. And I was like, I'd love you to meet Megan. And she laughed because she said, oh my gosh, Megan has been the example in our firm. People say, be like Megan when they talk about what to do on LinkedIn. So it was just a great story of like
excellent
visibility. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Do you post every week or every day? I mean, do you set rules for yourself on this? You have a fixed process?
I try to post 3 days a week, but I also don't force it. You know, I love the scheduling assistant on LinkedIn because we all know sometimes you have that great creative day where you have a lot of thoughts and I can create 12 posts for the next, you know, month or two. So that's the strategy I use, is I wait and I, you know, create a bunch of content once and then plan it out.
Yeah. And you encourage your team to do the same?
Absolutely. I want them to. I think some companies, they get nervous. I think it's the ones that aren't confident. If their people are creating their own brand, you know, they want them to create the company's brand. Like, not create your own. Be yourself. So I want everybody to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, listen, this has been a great chat. Do you want to leave us with one thought here? Maybe a tip or a trick or some words of wisdom as we wrap up here?
I think we just covered it. But if you're not focused on marketing or becoming a brand ambassador, or getting a personal brand, you absolutely need to start now.
Thank you so much, Kate, for coming on the show. Thanks. And we'll keep in touch and speak again soon.
Great. Thank you so much, Marcus.
Okay. Cheers.
Cheers.